Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, bringing you shows from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levinier. Coming up in this hour, True History. Later on, Myrna Loy hosts Memoirs of the Movies. But right now, it's The Cavalcade of America, a true story about an older Marine, Lou Diamond, in the play The Marine Who Was 200 Years Old. This from March 18, 1952 on NBC, and stars William Bendix.
The DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware, makers of better things for better living through chemistry, presents the Cavalcade of America. Tonight's star, William Bendix. Tonight's story, The Marine Who Was 200 Years Old.
What a joke.
Joke? He joined the Marines in the Revolutionary War. And what do you think of that?
Back in 1775?
Yeah, and he ain't stopped fighting since. Brother, that's a Marine. That was me sounding off. Corporal Jay Savitt, United States Marines. It was back in 1942. I was talking about the darndest leatherneck that ever lived. My sea daddy, Master Gunnery Sergeant Lou Diamond. Us Marines that he trained swore old Lou had to be 200 years old. He looked that old, too. He had a pot belly and bow legs. And he had a straggly white beard, maybe 5-6 inches long. Against regulations, that beard, but nobody opened his trap. Old Lou could get away with murder. Let me tell you about him. It was a blazing hot summer back in 1942. Us Marines were slopping through the mud on a North Carolina base. Every man of us ready to knock it off. Everybody, that is, but Lou. He was fresh as a daisy.
All right, you knotheads. This here's a gun drill, not a taffy pull. Next time, get the lead out. Stop chipping your teeth. You knotheads are Marines. You're Lou Diamond's boys. I don't want you looking like a bunch of... Okay, secure. 5-minute break. Hey, Sergeant Chambers, stand by.
Yeah? What is it, Lou?
Run the show for me if I don't get back in time, Pete. I got a date with the skipper.
Powell? What's he want?
Who can figure what a lieutenant's thinking?
Anything the matter with you, Lou? Last couple of days, your beard's been drooping pretty low.
Me? I'm in great shape, never better.
That's what you want the skipper to believe, isn't it?
Shove off, coxswain, you're loaded.
You've been beating us over the boondocks ever since we got that scuttlebutt about shipping out to the Pacific. You trying to prove you're on top of the heap?
Okay, so what? Somebody snowed Powell into thinking I'm too old to ship out. He slipped his anchor chain.
It's too bad you can't tell him that.
Yeah, I wish I could. Well, why can't I? Lou Diamond ain't never been known to keep his mouth shut when it paid to keep it open. Lieutenant Powell, you can't do this to me. You can't do it.
Look, Lou, there's nothing personal in this. Tell me, how old are you?
Well, I'm... Well, I'm only... What's my age got to do with it?
Well, the records say you're 52, but you've never told anybody how old you really are, have you?
You've seen me out there every day, Lieutenant, on the double. Everything on the double.
Yes, I couldn't miss that.
I can fight rings around any Marine in the Corps.
You've been at it for 26 years. That's a long time.
So what?
I know that you're the best mortar man in the Marines, but...
What is it, then?
Lou, this is a young man's scrap. Lord knows it's never soft in the Marines, but combat in the Pacific is liable to be the roughest assignment the Corps ever had.
Well, so who's worrying, Lieutenant?
I'm worrying. You have to be able to take it, physically.
I got a lot of fight left in me. You don't have to worry. Look, Lieutenant, those knotheads of mine, they can't get along without me.
Don't have to draw me pictures, Lou. I know what your men think of you.
Yeah, but it's more than that, Lieutenant. I can't get along without them.
Look, Lou...
Yeah, I don't go around shooting my mouth off about it. I wouldn't want them kids to know, but... Lieutenant, we belong together. They're all I got. Well, you gotta let me ship out with my boys.
Okay, Lou, you win. At least I don't have to worry about your spirit. I know that'll hold up. I just hope the rest of you does as well.
Right after that, our outfit pulled out for the Pacific. It was August 7th, 1942, when we hit the beach at Guadalcanal. And it was tough going. Guadalcanal was no picnic. But for old Lou Diamond, there were two battles. One against the Banzais, the other to keep that old frame of his from falling apart. For instance, Lou got two broken ribs from an exploding mine and a fat case of malaria. The docs knew all about that. But one thing they didn't know. They didn't know Lou was just about crippled with rheumatism. He could hardly move, but he stayed in there to fight. And he never let on to nobody, not even to us guys around him.
Hey, Savitt, front and center.
You pipe me, Sarge? What's the matter?
Now, what'd you do with them clover leaves? I need one.
Ammo? Over there. I'll get one for you.
Secure? I ain't no cripple.
Okay. Over there, Sarge. To starboard. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, I see him.
Ooh. Here, wait a minute, Lou. I'll help you. What do you want? Ammo?
Get your hooks off that, Chambers. What do you think I am, a dame? I can still handle a clover leaf. I ain't no cripple.
Yeah. I heard you tell Savitt.
I'm sorry, kid. I didn't mean to blow my pipe.
It's okay.
They pull us out of line for a couple of days, and the quiet gets on my nerves, I guess.
Maybe the rest will do you good, Lou. You look beat.
Who, me? I'm in great shape.
Hey, Sergeant!
Yeah, here comes the skipper. Maybe something's going to pop around here at last.
Sergeant Chambers, I want you to check our ammo supply. Get me a report on the double. You stick around, Lou. I want to talk to you.
All right, sir. Have it for you right away.
What's the scoop, Lieutenant?
I got some scuttlebutt a few minutes ago.
Yeah, we're heading back in. Is that it, skipper?
Yeah, maybe tomorrow or the next day.
Good.
They're swinging us over to reinforce the right flank.
Holy smokestack, it's about time. I thought maybe we was the lost battalion or something.
Pretty anxious to get back in there, aren't you, Sergeant?
Well, I'm a leatherneck, Lieutenant. I didn't ship 10,000 miles just to rest my oars.
Then you're squared away?
Top notch. Couldn't be better.
Thought maybe you might be worried about something.
Worried?
Combat plus Guadalcanal. That's a tough combination to take.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, Skipper, I have been kind of worried.
Yeah, what is it, Lou?
Well, it's them three cases of beer you owe me. That's what's worrying me.
What?
Yeah, Lieutenant. You're a good CEO, but you're sure one lousy pinochle player.
Hello, Mortar Platoon, Dog Company. Hello, Dog Company.
Diamond here. This is Mortars.
Is that you, Powell?
Yeah, he's on the way. This is Sergeant Diamond. How are you? What kind of brass you wearing, topside?
Gold leaves, Lou.
Major, huh? Oh, that's great, Ollie. That's Dinghow.
Stick around, Chambers. I may want
you. Here's the skipper now, Major. Here you are, Lieutenant. Major Oliver up at regiment.
Oh, thank you. Lieutenant Powell, here, sir.
Major Oliver. Well, how's about that?
Oh, right,
you know him?
Oh, know him. We were sergeants in China.
That's so. Lou, they say you've been off the commission maybe a dozen times. How come you always turned it down?
It'd take more than Congress to make a gentleman out of me.
Boy, Sergeant Diamond. Looks like we've got a detail.
What's cooking, sir?
Colonel Edson's raiders, they're in trouble.
What kind of trouble?
Well, they're over on Matanikau Ridge, and they're surrounded. Edson's men can't get through.
Well, then let's get through to them.
Oh, no, not a chance. They're going to be wiped out, and unless we can lay down a pinpoint barrage, and that's tough to do.
Well, why stand by, Lieutenant? Let's go.
Headquarters says that you're the man for the job.
Well, sure. Who else? Let's go.
There's only one hitch.
Hitch?
Well, from here to Matanikau Ridge, that's a bone-breaking march. It's cross-country all the way.
Yeah, so?
So you could never make it, Lou. Let's not kid ourselves any longer, Sergeant.
Wait a minute. I'll make it,
sir. I didn't want Major Oliver to know about you. I should have told him anyway.
Yeah, well, stand by, Lieutenant.
Huh?
Here, look at this map. Is there any way for me to get there by truck?
What? Well, where? Let's see here. Yeah, there's a way we might make it.
Okay, then. Hoist me on a truck.
Give him Lou Diamond on wheels. Come on, we got some shooting to do. Okay, you knotheads, hold it. Chambers!
Up 100. Right 150.
Give me 3 degrees elevation. Traverse to right. Let's put it in their laps this time. We ain't got all day.
Misfire! Number 3 gun, misfire!
Misfire, huh? Right. Holy smokestack. Secure that piece. Take cover. Chambers, get out of range! Okay, you knotheads, just take it easy. I got a date with number 3 gun.
Hey, Lou, wait a minute. I'm coming with you.
Now, look, kid, I told you to get out of range.
Lou, you're nuts. You can't hardly move. How are you going to do this by yourself?
Shove off, kid.
There's a live shell in that tube.
Don't worry about me. My baby's never let me down.
I'm staying with you.
I told... Okay, kid.
What do you want to do now?
Well, you turn the tube upside down.
That shell inside.
If she blows, you won't never know it, kid. Let me talk to her, and then we tilt her.
And the shell?
I'll catch her when she falls.
What about you?
I ain't never dropped one yet. Now stop your worrying.
Okay.
Oh. Come on, sweetheart. Come on, you little doll baby. Spit it out, baby. Give it to Daddy. Spit it out.
Catch it, Lou. Catch it. Yeah. You got it. Get that safety pin back in. Got it.
Okay, you knotheads, we're in business. Let's get back in here and shoot.
Sergeant Chambers?
Yes, sir, Lieutenant.
How's Diamond this morning? Are you just coming out?
I've just been talking to him, sir. He's all right, I guess, but he still can't get up. Can't even move. Lying there helpless in that sack, Lieutenant, it breaks my heart to look at him.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm going inside to see him now, Sergeant. Anybody wants me, you know where to find me.
Aye, sir, I'll pass the word along.
Lou?
Who's that?
It's Lieutenant Powell.
Oh, so confounded dark in this tent, you wouldn't know your own cousin. How are you, Skipper?
I'm all right, Lou. Question is, how are you?
Me? I'm in great shape. Never better.
That's not what the doc says.
Hey, what does he know? I just got shook up coming back from a tonic car, that's all. I'll be squared away tomorrow morning.
We just received a personal commendation for you, Lou, from the general.
Huh?
Colonel Edson's men got out all right, thanks to that beautiful barrage your boy sent up. Want me to read it to you?
No, don't strain your eyes, Lieutenant. I'll read it myself in the morning.
I'm afraid not.
Huh?
Tomorrow morning, this time, you'll be in a hospital in New Zealand.
Hospital? Me? Well, you're joking, Lieutenant.
I wish I was. The doc says you're through, Lou. No more combat.
Why, they can't...
This rheumatism of yours, it may be weeks before you're able to navigate again. No, Lou, this time it's final.
Lieutenant, they can't do this to me.
This is where I came in, Lou. Remember back in Carolina? I wasn't worried about your courage. It was the rest of you. I guess I was right after all. Loosen your leggings, Lou, and do what they tell you.
No, you're still wrong, Lieutenant. You're rocking the boat.
Am I? How?
Because I'll be back. No matter where they ship me. Just tell them knotheads of mine, Lou Diamond will be back.
On Guadalcanal, the docs told us our gunny, Sergeant Lou Diamond, was crippled with rheumatism and too old to fight. Lou screamed at them they were slipping their anchor chain, but they loaded him on a hospital ship just the same. And 8 weeks later, in a naval hospital down in New Zealand, Lou was rock happy, just about ready to blow his top.
Take that, take it away. I don't want no orange juice. I want out of this joint. That's all I want.
Now, Sergeant, be nice, won't you? Orange juice. Now, this is pretty special.
Bring me a case of beer.
Sergeant.
Okay, you and me will split the case, huh?
We do not serve beer in this hospital.
Well, that's what's wrong with the joint. You want to get me out of here? Give me my beer.
You know, you're the most cantankerous...
Girlie, Lieutenant. I ain't happy here. Combat fighting, that's all I want.
It's not going to be easy, is it?
What ain't?
Why, going back to... Oh, Commander Haines did tell you, didn't he?
Haines? What's the CO of this trap got to do with me?
Why, nothing. Nothing at all.
You want to get paddled, Lieutenant? Open up. Come on, what gives?
All right. You're not going back to your outfit, Sergeant. In about a week, they're shipping you back to the States for good.
What?
Oh, now, take it easy.
What do you mean, take it easy?
Commander Haines says you can't go back to combat, and that's it, Sergeant. What can you do?
What can I do? I'll get you. You... Yeah, I guess you're right, girlie. What can I do?
No use trying to argue with them.
No, of course not.
What good would it be?
Oh, sure, what good?
Are you all right, Sergeant?
Yeah, sure, Lieutenant. I'm in great shape. Never better.
Come in. You got those orders out, Corporal? Just sent them on to... Lou!
What? Huh? You and me's a couple of bad pennies, Allie. Keep turning up.
Are you a patient over in the hospital?
Well, I ain't wearing this bathrobe for no beauty contest. They got my duds locked up.
I didn't even know you were around, Lou. I just got transferred here myself.
Yeah, I heard about it. Major Hank Oliver, the new adjutant. You got here just in time, Ollie. I need you.
What are you up to, Lou?
Well, I got to get back to my outfit. I got to have my orders.
Orders?
Yeah.
Well, you're at the hospital. You come under Commander Haines.
Yeah, but he comes under you. You're the big boy's man, Ollie.
Lou, I don't think
Ollie.
I...
Ollie! Remember that time in China? Remember? When the MPs were on your tail and
never mind, Lou. I remember you. What kind of orders?
Back to my outfit, Guadalcanal.
No, Lou, that's against regulations. I just can't.
Holly, boy.
Yeah?
There's buddies and buddies.
Okay, Lou. How fast do you want them?
Holly, I ain't never been in such a hurry.
Once he got orders, old Lou really moved. Nothing was going to stop him now. He was going to get back to us guys in his old outfit. From New Zealand, he argued his way aboard a Dutch freighter bound for Guadalcanal. The day they put into the harbor, Lou shoved his way ashore.
Hey, Mac! Hey, you, Mac!
You call me?
Yeah, well, what's going on here? This place is loaded down with dog faces.
All right. What you talking about, Grandpa? Hey, where'd you come from? You Rip Van Winkle?
Listen, you army pup, don't give me no trouble. Where's the 5th Marines?
Marines?
Yeah, Marines. Fighting men, boy.
Hey, let go. What's the matter with you?
Where's the 5th?
Well, they moved out. Shoved off.
Where to?
Oh, how should I know? What's the matter with you anyway?
Out of my way. I gotta find him.
Lou Diamond tackled one dog face after another, but always the same answer. The Army had moved in, us Marines had moved out. Nobody knew where. That was when old Lou got rolling. Us knotheads weren't on Guadalcanal, so he was moving around the whole South Pacific till he found us. And that's the way it was. Island hopping across thousands of miles, pleading, begging rides by ship or plane. And everywhere he stopped, the same question. Have you seen them? Have you seen the 5th Marines?
5th Marines? In Tulagi? Nah, never heard of them.
5th Marines? They ain't no guinea, you can bet on that.
The 5th and no happy days. You lost or something?
So now I'm in New Caledonia and still no luck. Nothing but army. The Marines do the cooking, you guys come in to lick the pot.
Look, will you wait a minute? I'm trying to tell you something. I got news.
News, huh?
Your outfit, I just found out they're in Australia.
Australia?
You know where Darwin is?
I know every port in the South Pacific. I gotta get out of here.
Easy. Did you ever run across a Navy guy named Haines, a commander?
Haines?
Yeah, a medic. I just saw him down at headquarters. He heard you was around here somewhere, so he was sore as a boil. Hey, what's he got on you?
I ain't waiting to find out.
Hey, wait a minute. Where you going?
Darwin, Australia.
That's 2,000 miles from here.
What's 2,000 miles to a guy that's going home?
5,000 miles. That's a lot of steaming. But it didn't matter peanuts to Lou Diamond. It was in a side street bar in Darwin, Australia, that Lou found the payoff, the end of the long, weary road.
United States Marines.
Yeah.
At the 5th?
Yeah.
Oh, sure, that about, Yank.
Where?
Well, south of here, I think. In the brush, 50 miles or so.
Oh, thanks.
Hey, you have a tough time going, though. Not any transportation from here.
You see these two boondockers, Aussie? That's all I need. 50 miles, huh? I'll walk it!
And Lou did walk it, straight across the hot Australian plain. That straggly white beard of his got caked with dust and sweat, but Lou just kept on walking, adding up the miles and getting closer to home every minute that went by. And then, suddenly, in the distance, up a long, steep hill... Mortifier! That was music to old Lou's ears. It was us practicing firing. And in between rounds on top of that hill, Anderson and me was arguing the same old thing.
200 years old. Hey, you're rock happy.
Look, Anderson, nobody can prove it, you dope, but I tell you, old Lou must have been there when the Marines got started.
Well, it looks like he ain't going to be around for the finish of this little party.
We sure could use him. Funny going back into action without old Lou. Wonder where the old...
Hey, stand by.
What's up?
Coming up the hill. Hey, you see that guy? Why, that looks like...
Looks like... It is. Hey, Captain Powell. Lou's back. Captain Powell.
What is it, Savage? What's the matter with you?
Look, sir, steaming up the hill.
Lou. Lou Diamond.
Hey, you guys, look, it's Lou. He's back.
Whoa.
Hey, keep your pack, man.
Lou Diamond.
There still ain't no picnic. What do you want, full speed ahead?
You old son of a gun. Boy, God.
Okay. Okay, give me some air.
Lou, what the deuce?
Lieutenant, I... another bar. Congratulations, Captain Powell. Sergeant Diamond, sir, reporting for duty.
I should have known you'd be here, Lou. We're going back into action.
Don't I know it, Captain. I can smell it a million miles away.
Good.
Take over, Lou. All right, you nutheads. What are you standing around for? Marines don't fight with yak-yak. Let's get back in there and shoot!
And that's the story. Old Lou Diamond, the darndest Marine who ever lived. Funny thing, you know, we never got around to asking him how old he really was. And now we can't. Because... old Lou died last October at the Great Lakes Naval Hospital. The records said he was 61, but I still say old Lou was 200 years old. You just couldn't get to be that much of a man in 61 years. No matter where Marines fight for freedom and for liberty, the Lou Diamond legend lives on. Any leatherneck will tell you that, for we know. We know that old Lou... is always around.
Our thanks to William Bendix and the Cavalcade Players for tonight's story, The Marine Who Was 200 Years Old.
The Cavalcade of America, on Tuned to Yesterday from March 18, 1952 on NBC. The program starred William Bendix, who also played Chester A. Riley on radio and television's Life of Riley comedy series. It's an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levinier. And now on to Memoirs of the Movies. This episode, released in 1960 and hosted by Myrna Loy, we hear an episode dedicated to the birth of the Boffo. And a producer's note, there is audio dropouts within the program, but not distracting enough to bring you the great information and stories from Filmtown's past. It's Memoirs of the Movies.
Memoirs of the Movies, an 18-part series of recollections of the world of Hollywood, produced in cooperation with the Oral History Research Project of Columbia University. The Keystone Cops, the Pie in the Face, and the Pratfall. Those are the subject tonight as we take a look backward at a time when comedy was seen but not heard. And here to tell you about it, Miss Myrna Loy.
me that the audiences for silent pictures are increasing every year. I seem to meet more and more film buffs, and I think it's wonderful that the great silent comedies, some of which are now 50 years old, seem fresh and funny to young people. It may be hard for children of the TV generation to believe, but we really did not miss the dialogue in soundtracks. If the piano player or the band leader hit a loud note at the moment someone took a fall, the audience was satisfied. Comedy changed, of course, when sound came in. Much more subtlety and wit possible, and more sophistication. But when it came to violent action, spoken comedy was tame indeed. These wonderfully fresh stories that follow were told in 1959. Since then, Buster Keaton, Charles Ruggles, and Harold Lloyd, whose voices you will hear, have died. Host for the show is Joe E. Brown, a fellow with a wonderful gift for comedy, who began his career as a circus clown. When he spoke these lines, he just completed Some Like It Hot with Marilyn Monroe. Here he is now with The Birth of a Bottle.
This is Joe E. Brown. I remember the movies the way they used to be. Do you? Do you remember the days when movie comedies were to be seen and not heard? Do you remember that zany, gag-happy gang of comedians in baggy pants and droopy whiskers? Their frantic films have never been surpassed for speed and surprises. Or does it just seem that way in retrospect? The Birth of a Boffo. That's our topic. Everyone knows what a boffo is. It's a special kind of laugh that brings tears to your eyes and makes your sides ache. It's what a comedian works up to in laugh scale. The first laugh is a slow chuckle. It gets you in the mood. Then the yawk. That's really when you start to enjoy yourself. Then comes the boffo. You really have to hang on to your seat because the boffo is the biggest laugh of all. Now, a comic has to work awfully hard to carry an audience all the way to the top of the laugh scale. One place where a lot of comics learned all about the boffo was in a sort of a postgraduate school of jalopy-wrecking, bomb-throwing, and custard-pie-throwing of the Mack Sennett Studio. It was a college of comedy that was to be seen and not heard.
It was just a big open-air place with open-air stages, and he had many different companies there. And you could have one company in just, 25 feet away from the other one. There may be four or five different comedy companies going there with different ones and cameras grinding all over the place.
Just a skinny kid in those days, who remembers the Keystone lot? Dear old Harold Lloyd.
Sometimes they would get someone with a violin or something like that, but that was a little high tone for a comedy lot, see. The Keystone Cops, all these boys were very good. They're boys that had a comedy flair, that they knew timing, they knew spacing, and they were able to take rough stuff because, remember, they fell out of automobiles and ran into brick walls and jumped off of burning buildings. These Keystone Cops were, they had to be in very good shape.
Thank you, Harold. You might say that the Keystone lot was pretty much like a circus. It had an anything-goes air.
The Keystone was run by one of the most wonderful men in the motion picture business, Mr. Mack Sennett.
Eddie Sutherland, actor, director, and Johnny Factotum, who still admires and remembers Mr. Sennett.
Well, Mr. Sennett could do anything with all the writers and all the gag men and work out the stories. And the old days, we used to rehearse pictures, you know, in the Sennett days. We'd rehearse a picture for 30 days or 20 or whatever it took to get a story right. I'll tell you what would happen. This is going to be quite a description, too. And you sit around, and everybody'd have their bottle stashed in a different place into the in the room. And you'd sit down, you'd say, "Gonna have a couple meet in the park." Well, that's very funny. What are we gonna do about that? Making comedies, you work every night and every day. You just sit around and you get it funny. For example, we hit a spot in the middle of the picture that seemed to sag. And when you're doing that kind of a comedy, you have no media venue except humor. So it's got to be funny every foot. A great deal of this was based on the fact of discomfort, offended dignity. If a shabby man falls down for no particular reason, it isn't very funny. But if a dignified fellow with a silk hat who is pompous falls down, it is funny.
We all used to do rough stuff in those days, although I wasn't back in the very, very early days. I was never at Keystone, but as Eddie Sutherland was saying, it was rough work on the Senate police force.
Now, the Keystone Cops' life was a rough life. And there was a man named Tony O'Sullivan, who was the, kind of the mother superior of the lot. And he was a wonderful old jet, stern and tough as he could be, at the studio. And if you ever met you in a restaurant, you couldn't buy a drink or your food. He was just lonely. But he was tough at the studio. So, for example, the Keystone Cop life was this. You'd get into a car, a police, anyway. And you'd go down Edendale Avenue, which is in front of the studio, which had been carefully spread with water and soap and grease. And you'd go skidding around between, bouncing around, hitting telegraph poles or anything. You'd turn over. It didn't seem to get very severely hit, but you get pretty well bruised a good part of the time, you know. And on the hill was just an old California hill, were some enormous gin poles, so-called. Well, gin poles are telegraph poles, more or less, with a heavy cable stretched across the top. And then they put on you a harness, which they'd cut a hole through the back of your coat. That'd be a staple. And around that, they would attach piano wire. And attach the piano wire to the thing above, and you'd go up in the air from 10 feet to 50 feet, to whatever it called for. Now, piano wire is a dandy little thing if you don't kink it, because it'll carry the weight of a piano, literally. It's terribly strong, but one kink, it wouldn't carry an ounce. So you'd turn, I spent half of my life at the Keystone on that piano wire, because I was in the habit of maybe having too much fun the night before and getting in a little late if I wasn't assigned to something. Another thing about the Keystone, they'd play cute little tricks on you. They'd say, now, in this scene, Eddie, you come in through the door, and I don't want to tell you this because it'll surprise you, and you don't destroy your reaction. So you'd walk through the door and find a nice big live lion in the room waiting for you. So they got a pretty good reaction, I must say.
Of course, different comics work in different ways. The Senate style was pretty rough and tumble, as we heard from Eddie Sutherland. Now, here's a fine comedy actor who specialized in something a little slower. A great admirer of pantomime and my very dear friend, Charlie Ruggles.
One of the best exponents of pantomime that I know of was the little fellow that played with Hardy, Stan Laurel. And I don't think there has ever been a fellow that has been able to get his finger out of a bottle any better than Stan Laurel. And he could have gone on 500 feet of film getting his finger out of a bottle. And you are in convulsions. And you don't have to say or do anything. Let the audience, there's an instance of where an audience acts for you. You see, a comedy is a serious business. You just like playing drunks. You must be sober to play drunks, you know? But I think comedy is very difficult to play because the only returns you expect is laughter. And if you don't get laughter, then you feel that you are a flop. You see, it is the most ingratiating, the most utter satisfaction for a comedian to be able to control an audience. He kind of tingles inside when he does it, you know. And when he has some lines to say and the audience laugh at it, and then to know when to stop them from laughing. Unconsciously, it is the propitious moment and to go on to the next one.
And down at the other extreme, the pie-throwing end of the picture business, were three wild men who used to practice their routines at home. The Three Stooges. And here is the ringleader, Mo Howard.
In the early days, we practice. We get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we rip each other in the snoot, kick each other in the chin for practice, and then we jump in the pool. Tuesdays and Wednesdays, we practice by gouging in the eyes, hitting each other in the face with fruit and pies for practice. And in the evening, we would jump in the pool. And on Saturdays, we do the same, only that we would put water in the pool. We found that this was excellent setup for what we had to do at the studios. And I would say, in all due respect to Charlie Chaplin, who I think is the master of all comedians, to Laurel and Hardy, who I've always admired, I think that we, as of today, hold the record for the amount of pies thrown in pictures throughout the years. And as a record, listed record, at Columbia Pictures in 24 years, we threw over 670 pies. I hate to think of it, but that's so.
You know, one funny fellow who lived in the comedy world all his own. His world was a real nightmare of booby traps and breakaway contraptions that rocked the audience, but never even got a smile from this great comic. Of course, I'm talking about deadpan Buster Keaton, one of the dearest guys and great artists who recall some of his comedy.
We had to get sympathy and make any story stand up. But the one thing that I made sure that I didn't ask for it. If the audience wanted to feel sorry for me, that was up to them. I didn't ask for it in action. The only time I did it was, did it more in a burlesque way because it was one of the early two-reelers, this Hard Luck we were talking about. I started out in that picture because I was down in spirit and heart and everything to do away with myself. So I set out to commit suicide. Well, there's about six gags in there that were pips. Number one is I got a rope, got out on a sawed-off log, put me about 3 or 4 feet above the ground, and I could throw a rope up over the limb of this tree and tied myself off to it, bid goodbye to the world, stepped off of the stump. But the limb that I tied off to was so limber that it just let me go down to the ground with just a light strain on the rope. I ended up laying flat on my back on the ground trying to get hung. See, of course, it don't work. By that time, somebody over there says, hey, we'll catch that dog or that cat or something. And I got up to run, forgot I was tied off, and then killed myself. Then the next thing I did was go to Westlake Park and dove off the bridge, and I didn't know there was only 2 foot of water there, see? And then he broke my neck with that dive. I mean, not actually, but the gag. The last one was one of the most talked-of gags I've ever done in the picture business. I had got out by a country club in an open-air swimming pool, and there was a very high diving platform there for some professionals or something. So just to show off in front of the girls lounging around the pool, I climbed up the top of it and did a swan dive off of the top of that thing, and I missed the pool. What made a hole in the ground disappeared. People coming up looked down in the hole, shrugged their shoulders, and the scene faded out, faded into a title that says years later, faded back in. The swimming pool now was empty. It was cracked. Nobody around the place, deserted. And I came up out of the hole with a Chinese wife and two kids, pointed up to the high thing, said, I dove off there and went to, that's what happened. That was the fade out of the picture, and that audience would be laughing getting into their cars out into the parking lots. It was so darn ridiculous that there was no way to time the laugh, because if the audience stayed in there and watched the feature picture coming on now, they'd be laughing at the middle of the next reel of the feature.
Yes, that was Buster Keaton, one of the giants, whose pictures have never lost their sense of surprise. But while Buster never smiled, Harold Lloyd smiled all the time. He was presented on the screen as a likable but mixed-up kid who got into one darn scrape after another. Here he is. Here's Harold to tell you something, but certainly not everything, about working out his surprises in advance.
We'd figure out a scene, and we'd do the scene, take one. So then the next scene, we'd add a little more business to it. We may say take 6 or 7 or 8 scenes. But each one, we weren't just shooting it over. We were building that scene. I'd ad lib business as we went on. And sometimes by the time you'd shoot 6th or 7th scene, your whole scene had changed. You'd put so much more business to it. You'd eliminated what you started in the first one. Now, of course, that didn't always work, because sometimes you'd shoot a number of scenes and maybe not add too much business, and you'd find that you caught a certain spontaneity in the first scene that you never captured in any of the others. It was just a little spark, a little indefinable something that was in the first one, that when you played it the first time, that you just had to keep in. It had a quality that the others didn't have, even though they might have different businesses.
Probably the most celebrated comic actor in the world is Charlie Chaplin, whose little tramp character shuffled into the hearts of everyone. His style was unique, and so were the results. Working with him was quite an experience after the Keystone, according to Eddie Sutherland, who assisted on the Gold Rush.
We were doing the Gold Rush. Now,
I was Chaplin's assistant. I didn't direct Charlie. Nobody directs Charlie. He's a genius, in my opinion. I'm not talking about his politics. I don't... unfortunately, I don't agree with his politics, but I personally like him very much, and I think he's great. We were doing the Gold Rush. We devised a gag where we... the house that he and Max Swain were in blew away, and it got on the edge of a cliff, and it teetered. And Charlie and Mac were walking across the floor, and it was very funny, but it wasn't quite funny enough until Charlie said, "I know what's the matter here." They had had their first meal, and he thought he was bilious. He had the hiccups. That's what made it funny. Not just being tossed around. It was his point of view that made it funny. This was cooked up. Took us weeks to cook up this routine. The shoelaces were made of licorice. The shoes were made of licorice. The nails were made of some kind of candy. They got a... they made a mold and made pots of candy in it. Well, he ate it as though it was the most sumptuous meal served at the Astor on a gold service plate, you know, as he did everything elegantly. Once we worked out what he was to do, we editorially mostly, and Charlie was satisfied with what we had worked out, then his acting was feeling. And I've never known a man who could have as much apparent feeling in a scene as Charlie.
Well, that, ladies and gentlemen, was Eddie Sutherland, friend and associate to Charlie Chaplin, recalling the Gold Rush. You know, it was right about the time that we were talking about the Gold Rush, it was right about that time that something happened to screen comedy. Sound came in, and comics had to have funny lines to throw at each other instead of paint pots and comedy bombs. To make matters worse, the crews, the schedules, the budgets, and the gag writers interfered with everything, according to Buster Keaton.
The sound didn't bother us at all. There's only one thing I wanted at all times and insisted on, that you go ahead and talk in the most natural way in your situations. Don't give me puns. Don't give me jokes. No wisecracks. Give that to Abbott and Costello. Give that to the Marx Brothers. Because as soon as our plot is set and everything is going smooth, I'm always going to find places in my story where dialogue is not called for. And there can be two or three people in the room working at jobs. Well, they work at them without talking. Well, that's the way I want it. So you get those stretches in your picture of 6, 7, 8, 9 minutes where there isn't a word of dialogue. Well, in those, we get our old routines. And when it's natural to talk, you talk. You don't avoid it. You lay out your material that way. But don't call for a dialogue. And the start of the season in 1930 was our first sound picture. And then I made 6 more for MGM in the next 3 years. Every picture had got tougher. Like I said before, too many cooks. Everybody at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer was in my gag department, including Irving Thalberg. They'd laugh their heads off at dialogue written by all your new writers. Once that started, it took years to ever get anybody to even touch that type of material again. The Marx Brothers, most of their laughs are dialogue laughs. Joke happy. They don't look for that action. They're looking for funny things to say. And you just keep fighting that, see? They say, "This is funny," and I say, "I don't think so." Says, this'll be good, and it stinks. Didn't make any difference. We did it anyhow. I'd only argue about so far and let it go. And I knew better. The last 2 pictures I made at MGM, I knew before the camera was put up for the first scene that it was practically impossible to get a good motion picture.
The next voice you'll hear will be the man who wrote those dialogue laughs at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Now a top director, George Seaton, recalls in retrospect his work for the Marx Brothers in quite a comedy picture, A Day at the Races.
In those days, what Thalberg believed, which I still think was an awfully good idea, especially with the Marx Brothers, we would write what we'd call a skeleton script, just indicating the block comedy scenes. And then we would take it on the road and play the vaudeville houses or the public houses, the picture houses, for 8 weeks. And we played in San Francisco, Chicago, Chicago, Minneapolis, Duluth, Detroit, and around, and this gave the opportunity to the boys to work out the comedy routines. And it was just like preparing a show out of town. And then when, by the time the tour had ended, we had the scenes with new jokes added night by night, and they knew their timing. They knew how long the laugh would last, so that when we came to shooting the pictures, and Sam Wood was the director of the picture, he would know exactly by a stopwatch record how long to wait for this laugh, how long to wait for that, and so forth. So I think that this is one of the big reasons. It was done with two pictures, Day at the Races and Night at the Opera. And it's my belief that this is one of the big reasons that both of these pictures were very successful.
Yep, we're still trying to knock ourselves out, trying to predict in advance how long an audience will laugh. Why, in Some Like It Hot, we even thought of putting subtitles in during some of the boffos. But that's just about the finest compliment you can pay a picture. To laugh so long that you can't hear the dialogue. Remember some of the great boffos in modern times? And one sequence that I can never forget. The great human spider sequence in Safety Last. And here's Harold Lloyd tell you how it was done.
In getting to the mechanical end of the Safety Last, you see, I remember I had one scribe who was a member of the press that I knew very well. And he came around to me after the picture, and he says, "Gee, Harold," he said, "I think you got a wonderful effect." He said, "Of course, I know you was only a few feet off the ground." And I said, "Now, just a moment here." I said, "We were up just as high as you saw us. What we did do is to build platforms. But the platforms were built at least, probably 20 feet below us, which, as you know, that's quite a distance. And they had no railings around them. We put as many mattresses on them as we could. We made the platform as large as we could, but there was a limit to what you could do. So consequently, when you got up there, it did look like a sort of a postage stamp. When you looked at it from there on down, and it meant that if anything happened to you, you had to jump to this platform, and you had to fall flat, because if you bounced, well, then that would be the end of the whole thing. You see, what we did, we started on a one-story building, and we built sets on a one-story building. We built them up about two and a half floors ourselves. Then we went to a three-story building, and we took sets and built them up on there. And then I think we went to a five-story building, and then finally to the highest that we could find in Los Angeles. And the funny part is that we didn't work on the same streets. One time we worked on Broadway, another time we worked on Spring Street. And the backgrounds were really a little different, but the people were so excited in it, and even today when I look at it, I never notice the difference. You're watching the action. The action is all important, and the rest of it doesn't seem to count.
Yes, I remember seeing that picture, Safety Last, in New York. And I have never heard an audience laugh louder or longer than they did in that great picture. It was the kind of a picture that people come out of the audience laughing at, and we need laughter so badly, so badly. And I'm so very proud that I'm part of the business of trying to make people laugh. Safety Last was certainly one of the screen's most famous gags. And remember another masterpiece, The Navigator, starring Buster Keaton and the 500-foot empty ocean liner. Well, Buster picks up the story as he and the girl and the boat are drifting out to sea. Here it is.
"The only thing that goes wrong is the wind changes and takes that boat out of the Golden Gate to open sea. And the following morning, she's just hunched up in a corner, sick. I wake up, ring for service, no bells are working, it's a dead ship. I came down in the dining room, tried to get waited on. Nobody waited on me. And I went back in the galley. There's no cooks. There's nobody. I started to roam the decks. I'm on this deck roaming. She's on this one roaming. For a finish, I threw a cigarette down from the upper deck and it lit on the open deck down there. And she run that lit cigarette, knew there was somebody on board, and then started running. I heard her voice and started running. Well, we just kept missing each other because we go up and downstairs. The camera can see us doing it, but we can't find each other. We finally met. And, of course, your situation is that you've got two people on a dead ocean liner adrift in the Pacific Ocean out of sight of land. I mean, you could get two more helpless people.
Yes, sir, those were two great pictures, Safety Last and The Navigator. Real masterpieces in mirth and madness that was meant to be seen and not heard. You know, I miss scenes like that. And I think they were terribly, terribly funny. The sight laughs, just watching. I may be old-fashioned, but that's the way it seems to me in retrospect. This is Joey Brown. Let's keep laughter right in the very forefront of everything of our character. I think it's important. We make friends, we keep friends by laughing with them, not at them. God bless you.
This is Myrna Loy. As you heard, silent comedies had a kind of spontaneity that enhanced them very much. That's also true of talking pictures. I must bring up The Thin Man here, which was, I think, the first comedy about people who were actually married to each other. We made the picture in 18 days with 3 days of rehearsal. It all just happened in a breathless whirl. Perhaps it was even more breathless because up to that time, both Bill Powell and I had played mostly villains, gangsters, and gun mauls. Credit for The Thin Man belongs to that great director, W.S. Van Dyke, one of Hollywood's real professionals, who knew just what he wanted and how to get it. Thank you all very much.
Memoirs of the Movies, on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated recording from in and about the year 1960. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levinier. It's been a pleasure.